Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
A manager can call any collection of people a team, but unless the team actually works together in a collaborative fashion, they are not really a team.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for leaders of growing software engineering teams. I'm Aaron Syme, here with my co-host, David Alfaro. How are you doing today, David?
Well, this is my first week in Costa Rica after a long trip. I went to Miami, then I met you and the rest of the gang in Panama, in the Agility Fit's Panama's office. And then I went my trip down. I went to Rio de Janeiro, Sao Paulo in Brazil, and then I went to Argentina, then Montevideo in Uruguay, and then to Bogota, Colombia, and now here. Now, during that period of time, which was a month, I left a crew remodeling my bathroom.
Okay.
And then I came, during the whole period, we were communicating by phone, and everything was going, as per their perspective, going pretty well.
For their perspective, okay. I think I know what's coming here.
Yeah. So I was feeling pretty good during my trip, right? And then I came, and then a couple of things. So the toilet and the bidet, they missed the specified position by 90 degrees.
So they put it over the proper hole in the ground, but it's turned in the wrong direction.
In the wrong direction. Now, when I sit to do my business, I'm facing a wall. Now, then it's good for the back. maybe they were thinking how about my back because not how to keep a posture. So
when you sit down on your newly remodeled toilet in your newly remodeled bathroom, you are facing the wall.
I'm facing the wall.
Like the wall is right there.
Right there.
And they thought this was a good idea.
They thought, yeah.
Yeah. Because all you told them is I want a functioning toilet. And it functions, right?
It functions, right. The other good thing is that it impedes my use of the cell phone while I'm sitting. That's the other thing.
That's a benefit.
It's not that bad habit. Going to the toilet with you shouldn't, right? Okay. I can understand that, right? then I go to the bathtub. And these bathtubs are meant to be sink below the floor level, right?
Okay, so like a floor level sunken bathtub, essentially.
Sunken
was the bathtub, idea.
Right.
Okay.
They decided not to sink the bathroom. The bathtub, right? Well, now for me to get in, I have to lean on the edge like a fence and a jump. Because it's too high. I am considering doing pole vaulting. because I have enough room.
Right.
So I want to emphasize this. The fact that I have enough room so the toilet and bidet should have been comfortably sitting in the right configuration, right?
Right.
So there is enough room, right?
Yeah.
So much room that I could use that as a track to do pole vaulting to get into the bathtub. and then they bought the wrong shower. So it is a small disaster. Yeah, I'm trying to deal with this emotionally. But while we were having the conversation with Johanna, which is about distributed agile teams, and handoffs, and requirements. Yeah, I felt the pain through all the conversation because we are so good at this at software.
Right, right.
We are so good. And I made all the possible mistakes as the stakeholder of this.
Yeah.
As the financing person of this project. I made all the possible mistakes by the book. They got it wrong because of my fault. So I understand that. So I'm dealing with this. So this is a long introduction of how important is this next episode for you guys.
Distributed agile software, distributed teams in general are hard. We know the value, we know the necessity of them through our work. We also know how hard they are, but they are practically a given in modern software development. Until this conversation just now, I had never considered the possibility of distributed bathroom remodeling.
Yeah.
But it is also, obviously, very complicated. So maybe that should be your book to write. But today we talked with Joanna about her book on distributed agile team, the right way to manage them. A lot of wonderful lessons in this conversation today. So let's get to our interview with Joanna Rothman. Joanna Rothman is the pragmatic manager, a very well-known agile management consultant and author of 19 books on product management, product development, and even personal development. In today's episode of the Scaling Tech Podcast, we'll be focused on her book, From Chaos to Successful Agile Distributed Teams, Collaborate to Delivery. You can learn more about her at jrothman.com and by signing up for her Pragmatic Manager newsletter. Joanna, it's a real honor and pleasure to have you on the Scaling Tech Podcast. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm very excited to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. I want to start with the whole premise of distributed teams is something that, 10, 15 years ago, earlier in the Agile moment, movement, we were specifically advocating against that, right? We always wanted co-located teams. So maybe we can start a little bit with a little bit of background from you on your journey in that conversation point of how did you, when did you decide it's okay to do agile in a distributed team, and that ultimately led you to writing this book?
So certainly in the early 2000s, given the technology we had then, I was not an advocate for distributed teams of any kind, never mind agility, because agility was based on collaboration in the moment, right? Not handing off. And the worst part was I saw my clients were well-meaning, but the problem was they wanted to offshore very far east or west, depending on where they were in the U.S. My clients are mostly based in the U.S. I had a few clients in Israel at the time, but most of them were very far away, as in 12 hours away. And that's not collaboration. I don't know how to do it. There are ways, in the book we're going to talk about today, there are ways to manage that many time zones, but it's not true collaboration. So once we got when did I start using Zoom? I think in 2011 or 12. Is that possible that it was available then?
There were definitely tools available then. Yeah, we were certainly using them. I think we were mainly doing Skype calls without video at that point in time.
Maybe that's what I started with. Yeah. I was an early user of Zoom because one of my Israeli clients was using it. So I didn't know about Zoom until one of my clients, several time zones away from my home time zone, said, "Well, we use this tool and it's really good." And I thought, oh, fine. And then it was really good. But sometime in the mid, I was still advocating against distributed agile teams in the mid-2000s. But by 2010 or 11 or 12, it was very clear to me I needed to change either my opinion or I needed to change the advice I was giving to people. So I started to write to do workshops and deliver workshops in the mid kind of 2012, 13, 14. And at some point, I think in at the end of Agile 2017, Mark Kilby and I were walking on the Friday morning, right, the last morning of the conference, and I said, "Did you see anything interesting about distributed Agile teams here?" And he said, "No." I said, "Want to write a book about what's working?" He said, "Yes." So, and that's how we got started on this. But I think that once we figured out that tools could be a useful adjunct to a team with reasonable hours of overlap, that's when things really changed.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And I think that's about the same time frame that, David and I were starting to work together. We were building up Agile nearshore teams in Latin America, primarily for clients in North America and the U.S. And we were starting to see that. And I know for me personally, I went through a little bit of a similar journey. I had been doing Agile trainings and coaching people on always be together in the same room and shared open spaces, all of that. And certainly still see a lot of value in that, but was also opening myself up to the idea of working more remotely. But David and I had a little bit of, I think, push and pull between us of how that would work over time, too. I know when we were first starting our business, I was initially really an advocate of, well, we need to have an office in Costa Rica so that it's always a satellite office in Costa Rica, which was the only place we were hiring at that time. And our clients could interact with that office. And but it wasn't very long before David had convinced me that, we really can be completely distributed and be effective with our clients, right? And that, for me, that was, another step beyond, right?
And I want to add something else. We were coming from the 20th century. And in that century, the way it ended is that the only way you will have credibility as a business is by having an office and a very nice front desk that shows you are a serious business. And I think that influence. I when I began my third attempt to have a company by myself, it was a failure. But the first thing, the first priority I wanted to have is an office.
Yeah.
And that was part of the reasons to fail, actually. I mean, it was expensive and I didn't have enough clients yet. And then when Erin and I started working together, I was already in the place where I wanted to be very lean, the least amount of expenses possible. So I wasn't totally against the office, but I was way more convinced of not spending money in anything. And that's the way that I was able to convince Erin, actually, because it was less expensive. We have Skype. And he has mentioned this in some episodes. It's like the great transition was when we found a very talented Argentinian that was only, from Atlanta perspective, the East Coast was only 1 hour difference in the time zone. From my perspective, 2 hours. No, 3 hours, actually. But that's okay for me. And we discovered this person was really brilliant. His name is Ariel. Brilliant guy. Fantastic guy. And this person was the eye-opener for us. And then we started to actually hire more people from Argentina and then from Brazil. But yeah, from my perspective, the big transition was I didn't want to spend money. I really wanted to be lean. And it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, but even for us, it took a few steps in that process, even as, pros doing this over a decade now, that, we went from the idea of, okay, we can have, say a client in Atlanta and a team in Costa Rica to that team can also be partly in Argentina, partly in Costa Rica and that sort of thing. And that gets to something I wanted to ask you about, Joanna, is that, you know, in your book, you offer many different definitions of many different types of distributed teams. It's not as simple as just saying we do remote work, right? So how do you define a distributed team, and talk about some of those patterns of distributed teams?
So the nebula is where everybody is remote from each other. And I need to give credit to Mark for naming these types of teams, right? Co-located, we're all in one place, and within 30 meters of each other, really lower than that, but at least within 30 meters, right? 30 meters is the maximum. Well, even if you're a slow walker, it doesn't take more than half a minute to walk 30 meters, but we don't walk to each other if we are more than 30 meters apart. So, and we don't, that means we don't have the collaboration when we have a question. So, if you're co-located, it's all, you know, 30 meters within each other, close to each other, something like that. Insert the right English there. However, when we are totally remote from each other, that's a nebula team. Now, there are two other kinds of teams, satellite and cluster. Satellite is when you have the bulk of people co-located and one or two people away from each other, right, from the rest of the team. Cluster is when you have a couple people in Costa Rica, couple people in Argentina, and they're co-located with each other, couple people in Atlanta, couple of people in New York. That means you have all the cultural differences between each person, and you have a team that's not easily put together.
Yeah, I think that's, and Davida, I think that our model is primarily nebula.
Right, but
because everyone is generally working from home around these multiple countries in our team, but then we have some clusters sometimes, either ourselves or our clients.
Right. It is, yeah. So I think that our progression went exactly the way Johanna explained it. That progression was the progression we followed. I think that by default we are nebula. Accidentally, we have some clusters, like we have a cluster in Rio de Janeiro, and another cluster in Sao Paulo. But it's purely accidental, because what prime for us is the talent. I mean, whatever the talent is, but it happens that sometimes we manage to have an accidental cluster, and that works out pretty nice, actually.
Yeah. We've had. I guess just two intentional clusters. The first, our original cluster in Costa Rica, but now we don't require that, and that I wouldn't really consider that a cluster anymore necessarily. But we did have an intentional cluster in Panama City, and Jenna, I'd be curious your thoughts on this. You know, the one thing that we have mostly clustered in one location is our testing group. So we have some testers outside of Panama City, but our the first time we actually got an office in the company was 8 years after starting it, and I did that in Panama City in part to have a testing group clustered there, partly under the idea that, you know, we need to have lots of mobile devices to test with. And it's, you know, sometimes we were in a situation where a particular client was very concerned about one specific mobile device. We couldn't emulate that properly online. They had to have the physical device to test with, and shipping that to Buenos Aires, Argentina was not easy or cheap, right? So now we do have a testing group in Panama City. They do have a library of devices that they can work with. So that's kind of the one cluster we've had, you know, intentionally in recent years. You know, how do you see companies, if they're being conscious about it at all, deciding between these different patterns of a nebula, a cluster, and true co-location?
So, and I'm going to talk about satellite in a minute also. But the nice thing about a cluster for testers, especially where they need a lab of equipment, they have a built-in community of practice if they choose to learn together as a function, as a community of practice. Now, yeah. I would also like to see them invite the developers into the community of practice. That sometimes happens and sometimes doesn't.
Sure.
But at least they have each other as a community. And when you're, especially when you have combinatorial testing problems, right? And which tests do you choose? When do you choose to test them? On every single build or weekly or bi-week? These are questions a community of practice can answer, which is why it's very useful to have a cluster of certain kinds of people. Now, what I see that most of my U.S. clients are doing is what they call hybrid, which is really a satellite. They want people to come in either Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, or Tuesday and Thursday, which means you cannot depend on which people are in the office when. And they really think that it's useful to have in-person and Zoom or Teams meetings. But then they don't facilitate those meetings properly. So they always forget about the people who are remote because it's a satellite team. Or worse, they don't facilitate them properly. So every so often they remember and they say, Aaron, what about you? Well, no one's paid attention to you for half an hour. You went off and checked your email. Not right. that you would ever do that, but I would do that. Johanna, what about you? Well, what's the question? So I think that cluster teams are more reliable because people know where they are, right? Everyone on the team knows Johanna is in this location, Aaron is in this location, David is in this location, and we are all together. We understand where our locations are. But when the locations move all the time, when we have satellites that are impossible to know where people are and when they are, I think that's the most challenging kind of distributed team. The harder it is to make a real agile collaborative team, and that's what most of my clients are doing.
So how would you ideally have your clients design, most of them started these hybrid and other models, if any model, very chaotically, right? So how would you ask them to design it now if they could restart?
So I would say, senior leadership, take your hands off the team. Just stop imposing work conditions on the team. Instead, have the team create working agreements about when and where they will work. Talk specifically about workshopping, whatever you need to workshop, right? Do you need to workshop stories? Do you need to workshop roadmaps? Do you need to workshop how we will work together when we code and test? What do we need to workshop? And then do we need to do that in person in a collaborative way? Because while I am running all of my workshops remotely now, because it is so much better for the client, because I only work maybe two to 3 hours in a day, and then they have the rest of the time to practice. This right. is so much better, so much more effective than what I did before when I flew into a place and was there for 2 or 3 days and I flew back out. This is so, so much more effective. So I have all these sticky cards and I have index cards and yellow stickies, and I don't know what I'm going to do with them all, but I'm not going to use them with clients. Great. Right? That's not the best use of their time or my time. So when do we need to be in person, and what times of the day make sense for us? This business of spending an hour commuting into work, I live in the Boston area. I always plan on 45 minutes to go into Boston. Always, always, always. It should only be 20 minutes. Yeah, I always plan on 45. And I am not alone. So why would we have a meeting at 9 in the morning where we all have to be irritated from our commute? Why not start a meeting at 11 or 11:30, maybe even bring in some lunch? I'm normally not an advocate of working with lunch. I prefer that lunch be separate from work, but maybe that's what we do. So we workshop together for 3 or 4 hours, finish the collaboration we need to finish, and then go back to our home offices. Why not do that?
Yeah, absolutely. And why not let the team decide? Yeah.
I something to your stress in, Johanna, and I think is magical here, is fundamental, is that the value of collaboration comes from the specific moments we need collaboration the most. So that brings us the key to handle this problem, the problem of, let's not call it a problem, the issue of being distributed. It happens that for a big chunk of time, we developers, we appreciate being alone and working on our things. And but there are specific time frames during the day, during the week, during the month, that being together, we can decide how to be together, in person or Zoom. But these periods of time, we need to collaborate, and that is, and in a way that is intense, so we can get the most of it, and then we can go and work and do our stuff. We engineers love to do that, not being in meetings. But the reality is that collaboration, although it's expensive, because that's the way it is, it brings a lot of value. It is really, really valuable. But the fact is that we can make time for it and prioritize that time. And I think the message is that we don't need to be the whole day collaborating, right? I mean, there are periods where we have to do in time synchronous collaboration, and there are periods that we can do asynchronous collaboration. Is that right?
There is, and I would like to add something to that. Yeah. I have pair-written a couple of books now. I've participated in mobbing and ensemble programming, which everybody laughs at me because I'm an old, old, old programmer. So do I know what this language is? No. But I understand risks of products, so I can add value in a different way. And I will tell you that when I pair with somebody, I have about 5 or 5.5 hours of work in me. My brain is exhausted at the end of that time. When I mob or ensemble with people, I'm focused the entire time on what we're doing. I only have about 4, 4.5 hours. Maybe that's because I'm old. But I don't think even young people can really focus that long. It's such intense brain work that we really need breaks afterwards. So, but I don't need, I guess I will say this, I don't need that much focus for email, right? I can go off and do my email later and do a pretty good job. And I can keep stuff, if I really need to think about the answer, I can keep that for a couple of hours. I will just say this. Even if I need a nap after that intense focus, if I'm at home and if I've been collaborating at distance, I can take a 10 or 20 minute nap or a 10 or 20 minute walk. And I'm I'm more able to focus then again. But I think that we don't think about when we need to work alone and when we need to collaborate. Dan Pink wrote this really great book called When, which talks about our various, for lack of a better word, biorhythms through the day. And I used to think I was most creative in the morning, so I would do my writing in the morning. It doesn't matter. I can write at any given time because I built up that muscle. But there's other kinds of things I need to do either first thing in the morning or even in the middle of my afternoon when my energy feels lower, but my resistance to doing the work is also lower. I power through it. So each of us is unique in that way. I'm not sure that there is a right time or a wrong time to collaborate together. As long as we think about what does the product need, what do I need to do for this product, what do I need to do with my team and separately from my team.
While I was listening to you, it just came to my mind. There is a book that the title of the book is Eat That Frog. Have you heard the expression?
Eat that frog.
I mean, it is like the first thing that you do in the morning is eating a frog. And after that, there is no possibility of anything else can ruin your day because you did it. There is nothing more disgusting than that. So everything that happened during the rest is good. But part of the intention of the book is that there are, during the morning, if you tackle the most difficult thing first, then the rest of the day just goes really nice.
I was talking with a friend about this yesterday, and how do you organize your to-do list kind of conversation, I'm usually looking at here's the 3 to 5 things I want to do today, which is the one I've been avoiding the most. And maybe that's the one I should do immediately. Or maybe I need to decide that avoiding it means it's not actually as important as I thought it was. Or what's the quick win, or what has the highest risk, the worst impact if I don't get it done, that sort of thing. But yeah, I like that phrase, eat that frog.
Eat it.
I like it too. Yeah. And this is why collaborative distributed teams, if they can agree on that one thing that they're going to do the next day, today or the next day, whatever it is, they can decide how to attack that work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so related to this concept that you're illustrating very well of how important it is for a team to be, managers, keep your hands off, let the team organize their rules, their work agreements, so that they can adapt to how the different personalities and work styles and work to be done in the team might dictate how they work together, what's the best way for them to collaborate. There's another thing I want to make sure that we get to that you mention a lot in the book about the hours of overlap and how important that's an area that management, I think, does have a role in, right? In sort of dictating in an organization. So within a team, they can set their own rules, but how we organize our teams, whether it's nebulous clusters, et cetera, that may be something management dictates, but also where are those teams and how, that sort of, so talk a little bit about how much should teams overlap? How do you distribute them ideally?
So I really like teams with at least 4 hours of overlap. And the way you folks have arranged your north-south collaboration, you always have at least 4 hours of overlap. And even if you only have 3 hours of overlap, you probably can create enough hours of overlap with the team that it's okay if, I'm going to get this wrong, that someone from Argentina works with someone in California, right?
That's the biggest window that we deal with. Our teams are almost exclusively North and South America. Our clients are primarily in the U.S. And so, someone in San Francisco and someone in Sao Paulo, Brazil, or Buenos Aires, Argentina, that's as far a distance as we ever have to collaborate. So there is always a few hours of overlap every day, which is great.
And the reason, and the reason distributed teams have such a bad rap is because in the early 2000s, managers, well-meaning managers, thought that the wage cost, the salary cost of a person, was the defining factor in how much a project costs, which it turns out it's not. Cycle time is all about the determining factor for how much a project costs. So I was working with clients who had teams in New York and, well, developers in New York and testers in Singapore, exactly 12 hours apart. Exactly. There was no overlap at all. Worse, I was working with organizations where there were people in San Francisco, other places in California and the West Coast who were attempting to work with developers and testers in India. One of the worst teams I discovered was the product manager was on the West Coast. The architect was in China. They had developers and testers in Vietnam and India, and also in Atlanta. Those people had no hope of ever all the team getting together. It just was impossible.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, definitely early in my career, there were times when I was getting up at 5 or 6 in the morning or staying up till midnight or 1 a.m. to have calls with people on the other side of the world. And it was no fun for me. It wasn't any fun for them. And definitely it was not very collaborative at all. But I certainly remember early in my career and in the late 90s, early 2000s, before I was really exposed to Agile, I remember certainly managers in the companies I worked at talking about things like follow the sun. And one of my favorite quotes from your book, and you talk about follow the sun in there, but you definitely give a strong disclaimer to it, and the phrase what you wrote that I love is follow the sun is anti-agile. It is anti-learning. It assumes a factory approach to product development, but software is a learning and collaborative activity, not factory work. Which I think is so incredibly important for people to understand.
Well, I actually think that all of any kind of product development, especially software, but hardware also, is all about the learning that happens as people work together to figure out these interim deliverables. So a hardware deliverable is going to be a little bit different than a software deliverable. But a manager can call any collection of people a team, but unless the team actually works together in a collaborative fashion, they are not really a team. I mean, we are teaming for this recording, right? But we are not, and we have a very small vision or overarching goal, right? We have a temporary thing. However, most of the teams that we see, especially those teams where they're distributed over many, many time zones, the managers think those teams all share one common goal. Too often they don't. Because they don't share a common goal, because there's no way to incorporate learning, well, it's very, very difficult to incorporate learning. And the more we think about a factory approach to handing off, that works for services. It does not work very well for product development. And even the people who say, well, we did this for 3 or 4 months and it worked for 3 or 4 months. The team, it was not a long-lived team, and the product was not a long-lived product.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but in services, so follow the sun from your perspective, okay in a support model, but not okay in a development or product development model.
So I think it can work for a support model, right? If the person who has the case, documents the case, very well, which you probably need to do in a support model. If you cannot fix something for a client in a couple of hours, they're not going to be very happy, and we need to make them happy. So we need to document what's going on. But I often think of this even in the case of nurses. So thank goodness I have not been in the hospital since I had a child, right? And at the time, at all those years ago, the overnight nurse did a handoff with the person who came in during the day, right? There were either two or three shifts. I no longer remember because it was a long time ago, but the nurses did a handoff, and often with us in the room, right? They would talk about where we were, what we were doing, how things were going. And that 10-minute handoff per patient, that was useful. And that was a form of follow the sun, even though it was all in the same room. So healthcare, services, all that stuff really can do a handoff. But notice that it's a service kind of agreement, not a product development activity.
Yeah. Generally dealing with something that's more transactional in nature, a small chunk of work that can probably be taken care of in that shift. And if it cannot, can be handed off in a relatively efficient way.
And I will add
some form of documentation.
I will add to that, that if the task we are handing off is easily describable, I mean, that you can write down the requirements in a way that is no ambiguity, which, by the way, I mean this school works in a very specific environment, and the requirement is that you can write down what is required to do in a very precise way, so that the other person cannot misinterpret that, because that's the value of collaboration. Collaboration, you write that something, and the other person has the chance to correct a misunderstanding with you in real time. Right? I mean, that's the value of collaboration, part of the value. So in the scenario of the handoff is the task should be so easily to describe and so easily to understand, so that the other party can execute them.
And I think that the describability also has this inference of not having to learn how to do the work. Right. So you're still in all these handoffable situations. We understand how to do the work, even though this particular situation might be a real challenge, right? So I don't want to shortchange all those support people who are working in a follow the sun way. They often have a very, very difficult task to do. However, it's relatively easy to describe the context around the work and what the work has to be, and very few support people need to collaborate on a regular basis. And when they need to collaborate, that's when they need those 4 hours of overlap. So I see this a lot in my customer success and customer support clients, where they say, most of the time we work alone. They can be almost anywhere, almost any time. But when we need to work with our colleagues to solve a really critical problem that we don't understand how to solve yet, that's when we need our hours of overlap.
Yeah. And that's an important point, because in a 24-hour day, if we are doing a follow the sun model in some sort of a support or services role, it shouldn't be 3 8-hour shifts, because then there's no overlap. So we really need to be looking at four shifts so that there is some overlap for those handoffs so that it can be more than just a list of ticket numbers and JIRA that somebody's got to go read, but there's an actual conversation happening, hopefully.
Or we pay people for more time.
Right. Right.
Or, I mean, we actually have 10-hour shifts or 9-hour shifts, and we pay them for more time and fewer days.
Sure.
I mean, you know, this business of an 8-hour day, 5 days a week, we have more options than that.
That's true. Absolutely. Yeah, and it could still be three locations, but in each location, two staggered shifts so that it's covering 12 hours of the day, you know, of the day, for example,
right.
Something like that too. Okay. So let's talk about agile methodologies a little bit in distributed teams. Popular question, everybody, you know, common question I'm sure everybody wants to ask, Scrum or Kanban in a distributed team? Do you have a preference? Does it matter?
I don't think it matters. As long as you have a project rhythm, I mean, mm-hmm. I used to really like Scrum because we could define the beginning and the end of an iteration, and we always understood when those times were. And then when we had more distributed teams, more time zones, fewer hours of overlap, we need to decide when is the start and when is the end. So the fewer hours of overlap you have, the more you have to say, Eastern, 9 a.m. Eastern is on a Monday, which is a horrible time to start a sprint. But that's our start time, and our end time is this time. So I find that the more distributed you are across time zones, the more difficult it is to use Scrum with time boxes. Now, you can use a cadence of anything, and I'm much more likely to use a cadence of when to plan and when to retrospect and when to workshop and when to do all of that, which means I much more prefer a flow version of agility for more distributed teams. I don't care. Whatever it is that floats your boat. But I do care about the value stream, the cycle time. I want to see the cycle time measurement for every single feature we do. And that means I need a Kanban board to see where things are as we proceed with doing them. Because the delays the possible delays in a distributed team just pop up all the time. I want to be aware of them. I want to know when they are. I want to know where they occur. What people am I missing from this team so we could smooth out our cycle time? We could smooth out our product development.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So as long as you're maintaining, managing and measuring flow in some form, then, you know, the Scrum, Kanban, whatever methodology you want to use, it's fine.
Yeah.
Watch that cycle time.
Cycle time really matters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Johanna, in your book, you mention repeatedly the word trap. I think it is a very useful metaphor. I mean, so you mentioned a lot of traps. Can I ask, what are the most common traps that you've seen in teams in trying to implement the distribution part?
Yeah, so there's probably 30 or 40 traps in the book. But I think that the biggest trap I see is that people think that they can translate, they can just adopt agile practices without adapting them. So, for example, a stand-up. I am not very fond of stand-ups these days. I would much rather have people collaborate during a given day and as a team, so we don't even need a stand-up. And if we need a stand-up, I would much rather say, you know, The only question we really need is, how do we move any given piece of work to the next column? And we start with the rightmost column, the thing that's almost done, and we say, what would it take for us to move this to done? Or we look at the oldest thing and we say, is this still important? Do we really need to do this? Aaron, you said something like that earlier in our call, right? If I'm not doing this, maybe I don't need to do it. So in my experience, it's all about, we need to work the same way we do remote as we used to do when we were all in the same place. And that does not work. It does not work for stand-ups. It does not work for retros. It does not work for Kaizens. It does not work for workshopping stories. It does not work for demos. You name a practice, we have to change it. So adapting the practices are much more important than adopting the practices. And, agility has this big problem altogether, where so many people want the recipe on at 9 a.m. I do this, at noon I do that, at 2 p.m. I do this, we have a retro on this day in this form. So, and recipes are anti-agile. So,
adapting the practices is more important than adopting the practices. That's definitely a soundbite from this. That's a great, great, great point.
Now we generally prefer to engage. Actually, we engage. Let me correct myself. We engage only with companies that we can see have this mindset already. But from time to time, we engage with a company that wants to start this mindset with us, which is equivalent as making the first step with one developer. So for that scenario, what is the big advice that you can give them?
So I would say to senior leadership, I'm going to work with your team and I'm going to work with you and at all levels of the organization to reduce your WIP, your work in progress. Because no team can succeed if you're always piling on work. It's not possible. So, and my experience with my clients is that reducing WIP at all levels is the very first thing I do, because that allows me to progress with a team, a product development team, a feature team, any kind of a team, the middle managers and the senior leaders. And then I start to talk to them about behaviors. I use principles, right? There's a principles in this book. There were principles in my Modern Management Made Easy books. But it's all about, here are the principles by which I will work with you. And once we understand our WIP and our flow, to understand our cycle time, I will work with teams at any given level to increase a little bit, to make things a little bit better every week, just a little bit. And sometimes that means we focus on how do we collaborate, right? Because that's because organizations have such a focus on resource efficiency thinking as opposed to flow efficiency thinking. Organizations want to reward people for the work that each person does, except that most of the time, we cannot untangle all that work from the final product. So how do we work at all levels to make collaboration happen and then reward a little bit about collaboration, even as we reward people for their specific work? I mean, the team always knows what each individual has done. The team knows. And so you can ask the team. But this focus on really trying to dive down and untangle what every single person has done, I really don't know how to do that.
Right. For me, the big mind-blowing thing that happened when I met Kanban is that a requisite for you to increase the throughput of your system is to have a low WIP. I mean, that alone. When you truly understand why. And so that's my message when someone is trying these things for the first time is, it is not that we are going to become less productive. It's that just give me some weeks and some sprints, let me manage the WIP, and you will see the results in the increase of throughput. This works, actually. This really works.
Little's Law shows itself everywhere. Absolutely. Yeah. I have several posts about feedback loops, and Aaron, I will send them to you
we'll include those with the show notes.
Understanding the feedback loops in the team, which allows you to then change the feedback loops for the roadmaps, which then allows you to change the feedback loops for the strategy. But if leaders are always pushing more work onto a team, Little's Law rears its ugly head and it's all over.
Absolutely. Yeah. Speaking of all over, we're nearing the end of our time together, which makes me very sad because there's so much to discuss here. And I've really, really enjoyed this conversation, Joanna. So I hope that we can do this again sometime because you have at least 19 other books for us to discuss, and we'll have more by then as well, I'm sure. But this has really been a tremendous conversation already. One thing David and I like to often close these with is just sharing something that we found really interesting about this conversation. And then I'll ask if you have any other just kind of closing thoughts, anything that you want to make sure that we address in this that hasn't come up already. And David, I don't know about you, I'll start, but the comment about cycle time being more important than hourly rate to project costs, it's sort of an obvious statement in the sense that, like, I definitely get it. I didn't have to think about why that made sense, but that phrasing of it, that framing of it was so valuable to me and so important. It really goes back to this idea of distributed work, that it was originally about cost savings, was the main reason people started to look at distributed work and follow the sun 20 plus years ago in software development. And it's something that, David, you and I kind of struggle with, right? And we always, when we wanted to do this type of work, we were saying to our clients, we are nearshore agile. We are not outsourced. We are nearshore agile in the same time zone. And even if it's going to cost you a little bit more than you were hoping, there's so much more value in this. And if I could roll back time a little bit, I would explain it in that sense of, this extra collaboration that we can do is going to reduce cycle time, and the benefits of that cycle time to your overall project cost are so much more important than hourly rates. That's a really powerful framing of that thought, Joanna. So thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Joanna, any closing thoughts that you would like to share? Anything else we didn't discuss that you want to make sure to cover?
I think that there's one big thing. The more we work remote, the more difficult it is for us to understand what people are writing, because writing does not have the intonation. So one of the principles in the book is assume good intention. And if I could leave everybody with one thing, let's assume good intention from our leaders, from our middle managers, from everybody else on any team we're on, and say, let's assume that everybody wants to do the best job they can. And what would have to be true for people to act this way in any kind of a team? So that, and especially the more dispersed, the more nebula we are, the fewer hours of overlap we have, let's assume good intention and say, what would have to be true for people to to honor the work and still say something like this.
I love that. Assume good intention. It's good life advice in general. And that was something, yeah, in reading that in your book, I really appreciated that as well. It's when you don't see a person face to face, when you are distributed, when you're working across different cultures sometimes, it's really important to assume good intention in whatever they're saying, even if it's said in a different way than, you know, you might have said it or expected it, delivered it a different style. Yeah, I think that's a really wonderful closing thought for us all to keep in mind. Thank you so much, Joanna. How can our listeners learn more about you? How can they get a copy of your books? How can they stay in touch with you?
So everything is at jrothman.com, J-R-O-T-H-M-A-N.com, because I actually got a domain name back when my first initial and last name was fine. So yes, everything is there. And I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for your time. I know I speak for David and I both, and I say this has really been a wonderful conversation. We look forward to speaking with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally. For more information on today's episode and to submit your ideas for future guests, please visit scalingtechpod.com.